It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
No fear! No fear, no fear, no fear, no fear here. Declare your independence name. Ernest Hancock in the western desert of the Sonoran Desert, west of Phoenix, out in the Menet. It's very nice. It's very nice. You know, one thing, a lot, we're going to be talking to Marjorie Wildcraft. We've had her on like 7 years ago, and she's really grown since then into, you know, rock star. If everybody wants to talk to her. And she was one of the speakers at Anarchapoco. And people were just, everybody wanted to talk to her. Everybody wanted to sit with her. Everybody wanted to talk about, because why? Because it's going to be a food thing. That's why. It's going to be a food thing. Well, what she's done is try to make it easy for people to be able to get up and running like right now. You know, maybe you can live off your fat until, you know, some greens start coming up, you know. So it's she's the founder of the Grow Network, which is a community of people focused on modern self-sufficient living. You know, in modern, we're going to find out what that means. She has been featured by National Geographic as an expert in off-grid living. She hosted the Mother Earth News Online Homesteading Summit. And she's listed in Who's Who in America for having inspired hundreds of thousands of backyard gardens. Marjorie was the focus of an article that won Reuters Food Sustainability Media Award. And she recently authored The Grow System, The Essential Guide to Modern Self-Sufficient Living, from growing food to making medicine. Ooh, let your food be your medicine and your medicine be your food. Man, that's never more true than now. She is best known for her DVD series, Grow Your Own Groceries, which is what I want to be talking about. Just grow your own groceries, which, you know, lots of stuff to talk about, which has over 500,000 copies in use by homesteaders, foodies, preppers, universities, missionary organizations around the world. 500,000, that's 500,000 copies of a DVD on Grow Your Own Groceries. So did we hit the jackpot for you? Yes, we did. Beloved for her humorous, non-judgmental, get her done style, Marjorie raised two teenagers in Central Texas and currently splits her time between Paonia, Colorado. Did I say it right?
Yep.
Paonia, well, that was a guess. And Puerto Rico, when she's not building an online network, being mom and tending her family's food supply, Marjorie loves playing, running, doing gymnastics, skateboarding, acquiring skills from the Paleolithic era. Yes, she's part cave woman. Mmm, very sexy. But she cut her hair. She got tired of being drug around by her hair. And and experimenting with anything and everything related to food production and sustainability. I teach people how to grow lots of food in a grid-down situation, even if they have no experience, are older, or out of shape. I'm the founder of thegrownetwork.com, which is the largest online community of homesteaders. Well, if we didn't pick wisely. All right. Marjorie Wildcraft. Now, I remember when we talked last time, you know, you were promoting the Grow Network and such. It seems like it be a growing. You know, tell me about the growth of the Grow Your Own Groceries project. But, you know, the Grow Network, since over the last 7 years, gone up, gone down. What's the interest?
Oh, it's been going up, and we've just been steadily acquiring more members. And I have been just super, super pleased by the people who have been attracted to the Grow Network. You know, just people that have been living this as a lifestyle because they love it and they know the value of it. In the last couple of years, we've gotten more and more people who are just completely freaked out about the world. But our core base of people, you know, we've got like 120 volunteers in our forums, and these are people that have been growing food and making medicine. They've seen everything. They've been doing it for decades. And they're just this core group of awesome people, and they help out other people in the forums. And yeah, you know, over the years, we've developed a lot of other products and projects, usually things that I just really felt was important. One is treating infections without antibiotics. Like, there's a huge crisis with antibiotic overuse, right? So we found the skills and techniques that they used 2,000 years ago, you know, when those Greeks and the Romans were all slashing each other up. Well, some of the guys died, but most of them survived their wounds. How did they do it? You know, so we figured all that out, taking care of your teeth in an off-grid situation, you know, lots of home medicine stuff. But then we've also really been honing and refining how you take somebody who knows like absolutely nothing, and maybe they're overweight or out of shape, like the average American.
Right.
And how do you take that person, and probably in a grid down situation, how do you get them producing a lot of calories and even more importantly, nutrition, very quickly? So, I've been teaching this for so many years, and we've really, really got.
Okay, why quickly? You know, we gotta get you on now. What is the urgency? You know, why did that become a trait?
Well, because people don't generally do something until there's a crisis, right? Like, you know,
right.
They just don't do it. And so people are only going to want to start, the mass of people are only going to start wanting to grow food when eggs are $100 a dozen. You know, they're like, oh my God.
Yeah, but
really
you don't want to get chicken eggs, you know, and do it yourself, you'll die. Because you'll die. Yeah, I saw that when they started the chicken. Everybody, you know, of course, we've had, you know, my wife and I, you know, until we went on this trip, we had like 70 chickens. We were getting 2-3 dozen eggs a day. You know, our family. We were fine, and I really miss them chickens. You know, I've like, you know, now of course, you know, you grow some vegetables and have a hard boiled egg every day, and you're done. I mean, you survive freaking forever, man. You got some clean water. You're done. Literally, you're done. Well, we don't want people to do that. So yeah, chickens will kill you. You can't. So say it, the man. You know, you'd be dead with chickens. So what is it you're advocating as when they start? Let's just skip to the end, right to the in the beginning of the show. When you want to grow your own groceries, and you need it right freaking now. Now, fortunately, we went years ago and we got these 4-acre PVC seed, heirloom seed packet things, you know, that we bought several of those, gave them to our kids, you know, so we could probably start with that. But, you know, how available are seeds? Where are you going to get seeds? You know, how you want to make sure you keep collecting seeds and spread out the seeds and be a seed bank of seeds. And then chickens is going to take, you get them as chicks, going to take 7 months before they start laying. So it's, you know, let's talk about now, because this could happen like, it already is. I mean, you know, that's we're getting in the problem now.
It's already happening. And that's why I'm so glad to talk to you and your audience, because the early adopters have the advantage. And there are still lots and lots of people out there who are totally clueless and totally believing that things are stable. Prices are going to go down. Nothing bad is going to happen to you. And when they wake up, you're not going to, you know, the panic buying will ensue, right? Right now, you can go to Costco and you can buy bags of rice and beans and stuff, right?
Sometimes.
But you know what? They shut that down pretty quickly when there's too much of a surge. I mean, the Costco, I've seen it before where they've shut it down where all you can get is like 2 bags of this and 1 bag of that, yep. Right? You do shut it down. So, but it's open now. Like, you can go get that stuff now. The early adopters have the advantage. And absolutely right. You don't want to raise chicks to laying hens unless you want to do that as a side business, because you're going to make a fortune.
I do it because I like it. Grandkids love, you know, tending them. Oh. They're not that hard. They're easy. They give me manure I need, compost, and they don't piss me off. I mean, you know, chickens are freaking easy as hell. If I'd known they were that easy, I would have done them decades ago.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, so go out and get a small flock of laying hens right now. You know, build the chicken coop. It'll only take you, you know, a weekend or two. Get those things going. Get that, you know, get set up. Chickens actually are the most productive source of calories that you can get up the quickest. And that is what I recommend people start with. And really, it is pretty simple and easy. You know, really, you can just have this whole egg production thing going on. And the chicken coop and run really only takes up about the size of a parking lot. It's not a big spend unless you have like 100 of them like you do. But, you know, I really recommend people just start out with like 6 laying hens. A laying hen will produce about 250 eggs a year. They do need a little time. They take off when it gets too hot or too cold and they need to change their feathers out. It's called molting. And they don't lay eggs during those times. But 250 eggs a year. Think about it. If you have 6 hens, that's 1,500 eggs a year. And for one person, that's going to be 3 egg omelets every day for breakfast, plus 33 dozen eggs to barter, trade, give away, or use, you know, in other recipes.
When they talk about, you know, oh, mom's egg money, that was a real thing. Yeah, you know, she had her own little business going on the side daddy didn't know about, you know. So this is...
Well, let's not talk about the businesses daddy had on the side, but absolutely, mom's egg money. You know, there's this funny meme going around now. There's this picture of this Rhode Island Red sitting on her clutch of eggs, and they go, she's got more net worth than Elon Musk.
You know, this is, let's get to the, you know, the original question is speed. I tell you what's happening. You know, a lot of our friends here in Arizona, you can pretty much grow anytime except July, August, September. I mean, you know, when it's freaking 120 something degrees, you're making some effort, you know. But the rest of the time, there's always something, you know, you can be growing. But the, I see a lot of potatoes. You know, they're really doing this potato bag you get for like nothing. You fill it with dirt. You start throwing potatoes. You dump it out and you got potatoes. Well, you got some starch. You got some calories. You know, it's probably not the most healthiest thing in the world, but you're not going to die. Then you have, unless they go bad, but then you have different in the garden crops that, you know, sprout pretty quick or grow. I mean, what's some of the things that you want to have more long term? You want to have store it. You put the potatoes in a stew. You maybe get some meats, other vegetables. You can it. You put it up on the shelf. You got meals for later. But I'd be hungry today. I'm like, woo, I need to eat, you know, and things are costing $1 billion. And do I have my heat on or do I go buy groceries? So if I'm in a grid down, oh my God, I got a something. What are some of the crops that you suggest that, you know, are the quickest to make you not dead?
Well, as I said, you know, getting a flock of chickens and having eggs going, because you can always find something to feed the chickens, even if you're raising insects for them or something like that. And garden stuff, yeah, I recommend garden stuff. It's really hard to get a lot of calories out of garden, and I'm glad you picked up on potatoes because they are the most calorically dense. And so that's a thing for sure. By the way, potatoes are going to, you're going to have a hard time growing potatoes in the South after after the transportation system goes down. And the better crop in the South is going to be sweet potatoes. And with the sweet potatoes, you know, you put them in the ground at the beginning of summer. They grow all summer. They do fine in the heat, maybe not quite the Arizona heat. You might want to put some shade cloth over that. But then you dig them up in the fall or even just leave them in the ground. They historically, people would bury them in hay underneath their house because the houses were up on cinder blocks, right? And then they would just eat off of them. And by the spring, the very bottom ones would have sprouted again because they sprout those little starts, and then you just pick those off, put it in the ground, and boom, they grow all summer. So it was a perpetual, you know, sweet potato always happening thing. So now to answer your question, like right now we got food, another possibility, and it's going to take some skills to learn though, and that's going to be wildcrafting and foraging. In the South there, mesquite beans are awesome foods. You've got all kinds of different cactuses that have edibility to them. In other parts of the country, acorns are just such an underutilized crop. And acorns, if you keep them in the shell, will store for 2 years or more. In fact, the Native Americans used to think the 2-year-old ones had the finest flavor. So,
I remember doing tours at the Grand Canyon. You know, they would have talk about the mesquite, you know, beans and so on. But just like with acorns, you have to you have to, was it leaching or soak them in water or have them running kind of, I mean, you got to prepare them or they're way too bitter. You got to get some kind of alkaline stuff or whatever. So there's some prep involved with foraging. You got to have some information, and that's where you come in. Marjorie Wildcraft. I mean, I doubt your name is real Wildcraft, but you know, the thing is that this kind of information in your webinars and so on, you have this stuff for being able to do that, right?
That's it. And we've spent a lot of time figuring out how to get the information to you very quickly. I have a whole bunch of training classes we've developed, and I have personally spent time at pretty much every single presenter that we have there. I've spent time at their homestead. They're the real deal. They know what they're doing. I've worked with them on the outline. We've developed these courses to just get people up to speed very quickly. Now, I love my job because there's nothing better than visiting a homesteader who's growing amazing food because you eat really well. Yeah. But yeah, you know, and that's what I keep saying. The early adopters have the advantage, you know, go do it now. It's relatively easy to go get the fencing you need, or, you know, find some building materials at some, you know, Habitat for Humanity or some construction site, or go buy them if you have the resources, you know, the seeds, right? We all saw runs on seeds.
Is that now? You know, the seed thing, you know, do I even want the seed? I mean, fortunately, we bought a bunch of heirlooms, and they have some seed banks here that people do, and you check out and check in. I mean, you trust them to put the right ones back. But, you know, it's if I was to order seeds, where? You know, how? I mean, during when they had the lockdowns, they had the seed area and a lot of hardware stores or Walmart or whatever. As we were traveling the country, they had like crime tape around them. Nope, they're not essential. We have determined that seeds is not essential. You're not allowed to buy them. Like, who the crap did that? Okay, who made that decision? So this is a seed thing. Where am I getting my seeds, Marjorie?
Well, a lot of seeds are still available. Johnny Selected Seeds, the Survival Seed Company, the Sustainable Seed Company. There's still a lot of seeds available right now, and they have restocked. Although I will say, bizarrely enough, you know, that spate of food processing plants and weird things that have been happening. There's like five main big distributors in the U.S. of heirloom seeds, and one of them was completely destroyed. So,
Time out. Okay, an heirloom seed manufacturing place, distribution, putting in packages place burned down.
Yeah.
Where was this?
Yeah. You know, I have to pull that up. I'm actually getting that information from David Dubine from the Adapt 2030 channel. You need to have him on, by the way, Ernie.
Donna, send a telegram to Marjorie. We need to get who on?
David Dubine.
You know, where's David Dubine's contact information? Don't be a slacktivist. You know, have her give it to you. All right.
I'll hook you up.
No, I just want to make sure you're reminded, because we're going to be going down this road quite a bit. You know, I want to spend some time on this.
You know what also David's talking about, which is something nobody else is talking about.
Thanks, Donna.
And that is that a year ago January, a volcano erupted, and I'm gonna butcher the name. It was like the Tumba Kambamba or something like that. It was some, and the thing about this volcano is it spewed so much water vapor up into the atmosphere that globally we now have like 10% more water vapor, and that happened in just a couple of days. And when you take a closed system like our planet and you alter one variable like the water vapor in the air, that significantly, in that short of a period of time, there are going to be consequences. And David has been mapping this really, really closely. And there are two that are really important. One is, you remember the ozone hole that we used to, the reason we all stopped using spray stuff and CFC?
Fluorocarbons are going to kill the whatever, and there's an ozone hole in Australia, and the Sydney beachgoers die, and blah, 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 blah.
Well, that hole has been closing and closing and closing, and now it used to only be mostly over Antarctica, which is not a problem. But these microcrystalline, all this water vapor is creating these little tiny micro ice crystals up at the megastratosphere where the ozone is, and it's destroying the ozone layer again. And that ozone layer hole is getting bigger and bigger, and it's, you can see it on the satellite imagery. And what the consequence of that is, you know, other than the beachgoers in Australia, there's more UVB radiation that's hitting these areas, and UVB radiation from the ozone research that had been done in the 70s and 80s just limits plant growth. Like, you can expect crop reductions by at least 30%, and especially in barley and corn and wheat and the grains, really destroys it. So right now we depend on the southern hemisphere for crops grown in the winter to feed all of us, you know, in the summer, because, you know, in the northern hemisphere we don't grow a lot in the winter. We don't grow anything in the winter, right? And this is especially affecting southern Australia, where there's a whole bunch of agricultural land. It's especially affecting Argentina and especially southern Africa. And the crop yields will not be coming in this spring the way they expect them to. So there's going to be that kind of a jolt or a disruption to the global food supply of, like, oh, that's not really there.
You know, I remember when this happened, they were making, you know, hole in the ozone theory books and all that kind of stuff in the mid-90s or whatever. And that was the one thing they were saying. All this stuff, man-made, you keep going on about. Hell, in a morning, a volcano puts out 5 billion times as much as whatever you're talking about. And this is what you're talking about. All of a sudden, a volcano went, and all that man-made stuff is inconsequential, you know. And so these things happen regardless of governments or policies or war or whatever, just natural occurrences. How ready are you? You know, how much you got stored up? And I remember there was a exchange student from Finland that she was got paid or had it paid for her to do a video expose going to America, which is what she really wanted, is go to America, you know. But she came to America, and all they see of the United States was doomsday prepper on, you know, National Geographic of we're all crazy. And she's like, what are they talking about? She came, by the time she got to Arizona, we hooked up with her, and she came out in the desert, we were talking and everything, and she really enjoyed, you know, we took her shooting and all that kind of stuff. She said two things. One, all the preppers and stuff in America, they want to show me their guns. And she goes, but the other thing was, in Finland, if you don't do exactly what you guys are, they're getting all freaked out about you guys prepping and growing food and having gardens and everything, we die. It's Finland. You know, if you're not making hay when the sun's shining for 3 months, you're done. You know, she goes,
yeah.
So they were like enamored with this America, all these doomsday preppers. They're going, she goes, well, hell, that's everybody here. I don't know what the hell you guys are talking about. Who is? So she understood that they were demonizing this kind of thing because they didn't want you prepared. They wanted you to be the kook, the tinfoil hat, the crazy person. But regardless of whatever volcano, cosmic, blah, blah, whoever the hell cares, you know, whatever thing that's coming, it's always going to be a food thing. You need to have enough food to see you through these kinds of things. How long do you think? You think a year, two, you know, the Mormons are like 2 years.
Oh, I can tell you, absolutely. So, you know, Event 201 that was done in 2019, just before the COVID experience happened.
Yeah, here's our experiment on lockdown, and then, we had a lockdown.
Well, in 2015, Cargill sponsored, and Cargill, by the way, is the largest privately held company on the planet, and they have their fingers in just about every aspect. Food production, distribution, production, you know, everything. They are huge. They basically control a lot of the world's food supply. Well, they conducted a scenario in 2015, and the scenario started like in 2020, and it was called the food chain reaction. And they said, oh, there's going to be like maybe some major big event in 2020, and then there's going to be this series of weather calamities where there's drought here and flooding there and whatever here. And there's going to be this series of crop failures, and then there's going to be this and that. And then they said, okay, well, the price of food is going to first double and then triple. It'll go up to at least 400% of our baseline number, and it will stay there for the rest of the decade. Now, they did not include inflation, hyperinflation, and currency collapse. They were just talking about food prices going up because of lack of availability. Well, last year, you know, within the last year, food has basically doubled in price. Vegetable, eggs went up 244%. This is using the government's own numbers, right? Who knows what it really is? You know, produce went up 86%. Meat's been going up meat's going up so much. Joel Salatin, who's America's farmer, he does this purely grass-fed, you know, rotational goodness pasture stuff. Used to be expensive. He said people are buying his meat now because his meat's cheaper than the conventional store in the grocery store. So the food chain reaction, they said this, and they are, it's basically the WEF and the UN and whatever, you know, they're very open about their plans now. It used to be a big conspiracy in Agenda 21, right? Remember, we all thought I thought I was crazy for believing it. Now they changed the name to 2030, and now it's on the table. They're explaining what they're doing, and they're giving you the plan for anybody who is open enough to listen. But anyway, the 2015 food chain reaction planned a food crisis that would last at least a decade. And what would happen? How many people would die of starvation? Where would there be rioting that would break out all over the world? What wars would get started over this? They simulated the whole thing. And you can still see it. It's on the internet. They took down all the really bigger parts and the juicier parts. And their solution, which I never really quite understood, they were like, at the end of the simulation, cooperation won the day and a carbon tax solved all our problems. And I'm like, what? How did that...
Because they can. You know, it's just so stupid. You know, it's, you know, what is going to be the biggest detriment, the one thing that, you know, kind of would lower our standard of living and our health and availability of food more than anything else? Is it lack of information, lack of, you know, motivation, get off your ass and do it? Is it intentional government, you know, Stalin starve you out, kill you kind of thing? I mean, where do you think the threat is from? Is it us or is it them? What?
Well, I think it's a combination of all of that, because no matter how bad it gets, there's going to be a lot of people who just aren't going to do it. They aren't going to do what they need. They'll go ahead and take that CBDC or whatever to get whatever million portions that the government's going to give them, and they're going to get in line with that project, or they're not going to grow food, and then they're going to try and steal it from you or rob or whatever they have to do. I mean, that is going to happen. We know that happens historically, even to the, you know, upright Germans in Weimar Germany. They just went nuts and did that kind of thing.
Hey, starvation will do that to you, man. I mean, you know, you'd be hungry, you know, bow, bow, bow. I mean, stuff happens.
Yeah. Now let me go to the second thing that David's talking about with this volcanic eruption. And that is that the same thing happened back in 1815, where there was this volcano that erupted and put a bunch of stuff into the atmosphere. And in 1816 was the year without a summer. And I've even read historical accounts of that here in the U.S., but it happened worldwide, or especially all in the Northern Hemisphere. And it's not like the world goes dark or anything. But you don't have to have much blocking of the sun to really interfere with plant growth and crop yields. And so, you know, of course, they're going to blame that on.
Yeah, it was a volcano. Was it Krakatoa or Samoa? Something.
They'll blame that on some you driving your car or fossil fuel. They'll blame it on anything.
No. I mean, when the year without a summer, it was a big volcanic explosion or something. Of course, back then they didn't know what the hell happened. But you know, you go back in history, it was a volcano, right?
Yeah, and so this other volcano that erupted a little over a year ago, and David is working very diligently and has some really interesting correlations between, for example, there have been all kinds of freak hailstorms that are indicative of the same thing that happened back in 1815 and 1816. And he's saying, look, nature is telling us a year or a season, we're now a season ahead of what's going to happen. And so crop production globally, I don't know whether the volcano was planned or not, but that is going to be putting a whole nother lid on crop production. So the answer of why is it? Well, people know there's going to be a lot of people that aren't going to do it. I know that's not this community, because this community is very, very forward thinking and very proactive. You guys know what's going on. You know what's coming. You navigated through the whole COVID experience, right? Which is one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. It's the pestilence. And it was pretty easy to navigate. You saw what to do. You got around that. the next horseman in the apocalypse is famine. And I'm telling you, it's pretty easy to do that and to navigate it, to grow your own food. And you're going to have to grow your own food in order to get through this next time period. Actually, our community needs to be growing our own food because the commercial food supply is friggin' toxic. So you can do that. I know this community will do that. And that's part of the reason I'm on the show here, is to get people to do it. And that's what I've been spending years, is figuring out the easiest way to help you to be able to do it. So anyway, you get David on. He's going to talk about the year without a summer and how horrific that was. Right now, he's knee deep, ear deep in, we're all trying to assess with the Ohio trail derailment.
Yeah, and then, oh my God.
Why on earth would they ever burn the chloride
or whatever? Yeah,
why would they do that? And then how that cloud was huge. How big was that? How much of it is hitting the soils? You know, how, you know, what is the toxicity level? How big of an area? I mean, if that covers three states and we knock
Ohio and Pennsylvania, that's fertile freaking growing places. And they, and FEMA, not coming. I mean, not that I'm a fan of waiting on the government, but for them to send a gazillion dollars to Ukraine and then Ohio can suck it. I'm going, who has faith in these people anymore? I mean, come on.
I don't think there's anything you can do about it. And actually, I was talking to Dave about this, and I'm like, we've both been wondering, you know, part of the Agenda 2030 conversation is we're going to move everybody out of the countryside and get them into going into the big mega cities. And I was always wondering, how are they going to do that? You know, because how do you get, you know, and especially right there in Pennsylvania and Ohio is the heart of Amish country. How would you ever get the Amish off the land? Well, the only way you could do it would be...
That sucks. You know, because my wife, Donna, is from central Pennsylvania at State College, Penn State there. You know, she's a townie, went to Penn State and so on. And, you know, we go around, you know, Amish communities, you know, looking to buy trinkets and trash. They got good crafts. And, you know, I got a rocking chair for my mom kind of thing. And a Bentwood thing. And then I'm going... they have a lot of farmland. They have a good community there. They're isolated. What depression? I mean, you know, they wouldn't know the difference. Yeah. You know, we had chickens. And then all of a sudden, if you pollute the living crap out of them, and all of a sudden, well, the Amish be in the welfare line or probably not. I mean, they'll take care of business. But, yeah, I didn't even think of that. It was weird the way they chose to handle this. There's some nefarious evil. I'm not even going to go down that road. It's just let's stipulate that food production, food availability is precariously, you know, on the edge of, it's not going to supply what we need. So, you know, when they talk about Liberty Gardens in World War II, and then now they were talking about all this stuff happened in just the last few months. They're going, yeah, we need Liberty Gardens again. We need to get us some, you need to have a Liberty Garden. Make sure you get a Liberty Garden and register it with the man. And I went, what? Did you remember that?
No, I haven't seen that. That's
Yeah. They want to have.
You got to get your garden and register it.
Right. So what does that tell you? You know, tell me about. You know, real quick, I want to sum up, you know, before we get to Puerto Rico, you go in there, is that I asked, what crop do I need to plant right away to not die? You know, just skip to the end. Tell me a couple of crops. I want to get that in.
You know, actually, what I would really recommend is just go buy a bunch of food in bulk and store it really, really well. But yeah, you know, living in Arizona.
But then right after you buy that, you need to start planting to replenish. Yeah. With what?
Well, right after that, I would start going where you live, sweet potatoes, and of course, planting trees that are going to produce stuff for you, or identifying all the trees around you that produce stuff, like the mesquite or the different cacti or things. But people always think about... you know, gardens when they think about this. And I'm like, no, you know what? Animal production is way more efficient at producing calories and fat than food than vegetables are. And the next thing I'd recommend you do is get some rabbits and start a rabbitry. And so with one buck and three breeding does, and again, this would fit in the size of a parking lot, you'll get about 75 rabbits a year. That's enough protein for a family of four. And if you think a rabbit is very equivalent to a chicken. So all your recipes for chicken, you can substitute with rabbit. I've often fed people.
Yeah, but rabbits don't lay eggs.
No, but they are meat. They're meat rabbits.
No, so you would need, I like having chickens, but I didn't butcher them. We did turkeys one year, just show what a man I am to make a turkey dinner. But I mean, Donna's like, you're just so not with, you didn't do a turkey. Finally, we did it one year. And after slaughtering turkeys, it kind of, took the fun out of it. But the, so.
Well, let me make a distinction for you about omnivores versus herbivores. So turkeys and chickens are omnivores. And they often compete for food sources that you yourself would like to eat. Like we feed chickens grain, or they like to eat vegetable. They like to eat the things we like to eat. Rabbits are, and herbivores like cattle, rabbits are way better because they're small and it's a lot easier to process them. And they're good in a grid down situation. Like butchering a cow, I promise you, it's a weekend project for several families. It's a lot of work. But a rabbit, I can butcher a rabbit, have the whole thing cleaned up and ready to go in like 15 or 20 minutes, and I'm slow. So, and then you just cook it immediately, and you know, there's no refrigeration required. But a rabbit is very equivalent to a chicken in terms of meat. So, you know, with 75 rabbits a year, that's like a rabbit, that's like a chicken and a half a week to eat for meat. And they eat grass, they eat leaf trimmings. In the wintertime, they eat the bark off of young trees. You know, they're herbivores. They eat a lot of stuff that we don't eat, and they convert it into protein and fat. If you think about your garden, there are no vegetables that have fat in it. Like, you don't have any fatty zucchini. There's nothing fatty about a garden.
Yeah, but you can't mix rabbits and vegetable gardens. I mean, you got to keep them separate.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You can't mix chickens and vegetable gardens. They do chickens and everything.
I know, that's true. Well, the one thing the chickens I like is the eggs. You know, I really am an egg guy, and that's just a ready-made freaking kit of, and they last and they're awesome. But for meat, we have a friend in Pensacola, Florida that raises a bunch every, 6 months a year. They harvest hundreds of chickens, him and his partner's friend, nearby, they go through that. And then that's like a thing,
My family and I used to do that every year. We'd raise like 100 chicks, raise them up to meat size. It's like a 3 month project. And then the whole over a couple of weekends, we'd process them all and put them in the freezer. It requires a lot of chicken feed in order to be able to do that. And now chicken feed is chicken feed, right? Chicken feed is soon going to be so expensive, you're not going to be using it to feed chickens.
Rabbit.
So that's why rabbits are a much better, and rabbits reproduce like rabbits.
But they don't make eggs. I like eggs.
That's why you need different sources.
I'm for both. You don't have to do just one.
Yeah, you got your rabbits for meat, your chickens for eggs, you got a little garden for the nutrition and the fiber and the carbohydrates. Hopefully you got a couple of fruit trees for different nuts or fruits or things. You got to have a lot of different sources, absolutely.
Well, that's one thing, the land that we're negotiating for is 20 acres, but it's arid freaking desert of, oh my God. And we're really, rather than counting on a well, I really want to do rainwater, collection and so on. And because we have such big storms and you get the runoff going into a certain area that you dig a whole clay line and put a bunch of rocks in there and whatever, you got your own freaking underground lake.
Yeah.
But rainwater is easy here as enough to supply Donna and I and keep a tank full. That's not the problem. It's when you start having animals and, do garden, and then you start sucking up some water. And if you want to have a pasture or a chicken tractor kind of go around and have a nice soccer field for grandkids kind of thing, you got to have some work. Well, as we're doing the design on this, I got to design, my food production. This is going to be, then you get you're getting more and more tied to the land. Then you got to have like staff or, friends or family come out and, I'm going to leave for a week. Well, man, you better have a charming robot that's going to do everything for you, or like when you go to Anarchapoco, somebody had to water your crap, doing stuff.
Yep.
So it's, which I don't have a problem with, just out of the demonstration of, but the first thing you do is like what you're talking about. First, you you know, beans are relatively cheap and they're relatively still available. I remember years ago, God, it was around 2000 when they ran out of rice. You know, you go to Home Depot, they didn't have rice. Rice would be gone. You know, it was a shortage of rice here in America. Well, of course, we're not big rice growers, but we're eaters. And then, you know, there's been times that you didn't have beans, and there's times that you didn't have. So a lot of that you could just accumulate yourself. Well, then we did, God, it was like 13 of these big blue poly barrels that we had throughout our house, and every closet had one, and then the garage. And we just had it full of, got Mylar bag with the seal of whatever the hell. And we made, we got all this food. And then I realized the biggest space accumulation was the fuel to be able to cook it. So then we got, you know, somebody gave us a Sun oven, you know, one of our listeners was complaining about it. And I go, February here in Arizona, 50 minutes, I was baking a perfect browning loaf of bread in a Sun oven. And I went, woo, man, I can live by, you know, bread alone for a little while. So I said, I go, Donna, get a recipe of this awesome bread she was making. Now multiply it times 365 and get that much. I want a loaf a day. I want enough for, you know, yeast and flour, and we had the eggs, we got, you know, whatever. So she did that. We put it in the barrels. Then we went on the Love Bus Liberty Tour in May of 2020. We distributed all that to our grandkids and kids. And we said, All right, it's y'all's. Because we're going to put it, you know, let it bake out in storage in the sun. But so they got it all. So now we need to refurb again, which we probably need to anyway, because, you know, things get dated. So when they start getting all kinds of stupid, we probably got good 6 months at least of food on the bus with, you know, Donna and I, because what are we getting? You're getting rice and beans, black-eyed peas and beans, and some, you know, kind of meat, and you put it in the air done, you know? But what we've been doing since we got back from Anarchapoco, all right, now we got to start getting healthier, and we got to do Occupy. So what do? Well, she gets in, she calls them health shots that my daughter does, little citrus things or whatever the hell they are. And I got turmeric and ginger and spice, all kinds of crap. And then it's the green stuff. Well, I drink one big giant she did all day of juicing of the green kind of, I don't want to eat for 2 days. And it's probably because you get all nutritionized up and so you lose weight because you're just not hungry, you know? So we are doing that now, but I need to have the vegetables. I need to get some green leafy stuff. I need to, you know, kind of, so now we got our storage to kind of get us through so that we have the time to start gardening. So now, you know, let's talk about, you know, you want to do potatoes, you want to have, you know, some calories, some starch in your diet. And that was the big thing. Everybody always, I'm going, why does everybody grow zucchini? I mean, I got these freaking big giant, oh my God, to take the whole family that zucchini. Oh, look at my zucchini. I love you here. Give me a zucchini. What the hell am I going to do with this? You know,
because it's so easy to grow. I totally know that, man. I grew this one zucchini. It's like I called it a zucchini gun. It was bigger than an AR-15. It was crazy. And you know what? That thing was delicious, even as big as it was. People give you zucchini, but you really only need like one or two zucchini plants, and you're going to have all the zucchini you need.
Yeah.
There's a reason that the peoples of the Americas had three major crops. They had corns, bean, and squash. And the squash, because squashes are so prolific and they grow well. Same with the beans. They're easy to grow and they grow well. They're also a good source of protein. And then corn, it's a great crop. Produces a lot of grains.
Yeah, so if you can get a non-Monsanto, you know, corn seed, you know, but the... Well, that's one thing. Talk about that. You know, the quality of the seeds. They keep going, oh, get heirloom. Well, then they just throw organic, new and improved heirloom on the label, and that don't mean anything to me. So, what am I looking for when I'm looking for seeds? Is there a brand that you recommend?
Well, there's a term called open pollinated is really the brand is the term you're looking for. If something is a hybrid and it has like a C1 or a D1, it has these letters to it, that's definitely something you don't want. But something that's been open pollinated, and what that means is it naturally was pollinated, and the seeds that you collect from that will grow true to what that plant was, and you can plant them and grow them in perpetuity. So they're not genetically modified. They will produce. So it's called open pollinated seeds. The Sustainable Seed Company is a really good seed company. Johnny's Selected Seeds is another good company. I see. You know what? I'll tell you what. Let me. I was just actually putting some posts up on your website, and I will put up a thing on seed companies. We regularly have an updated list of recommended seed companies that we have, and I'll get that up on.
Yes, do it. You know, that's one thing. I gave Marjorie Ryder status on Freedom's Phoenix so she could share directly with you guys, and if she's willing to do that. Crap, man, she'll be all over the place, you know. I don't care. And that's one thing that we're putting up more. We got a couple of ads up. They had some ready-made sizes and they're customizing some others, and you'll see, you know, the webinars up there, and you go through and we'll get a something. I don't know what it is. I don't care, but you know, it's so that you go there and you can order these DVDs. This is information, and the webinars that she has is that you keep hearing me for the past forever. I'm going, certainly in the last couple of years, I'm going, this is going to be a food thing. And it's already started. Ernie, how'd you know? How'd you not know? I mean, it's going to be a food thing. So I just want to make sure that you take seriously this opportunity with Marjorie Wildcraft having, you know, access to this, because she's known it's going to be a food thing. You know, tell me about your move from Texas to Puerto Rico. When the hell, what the heck was that?
Well, I moved actually to Colorado for a while. And, you know, it's kind of neat. You know, I like living in different regions because I can learn to grow in that region. And you learn so much more when you completely change up all the seasons. And it really just deepens what you understand. But, you know, I was born in South Florida, and I love the tropics. Florida is not a good place to be anymore. Oh, my God. No. And Puerto Rico, I just really liked it. It's a little bit edgy. The infrastructure here is horrible, which means that everybody has solar panels or backup generator. I mean, everybody here is a prepper by default, kind of like your friend in Finland. They know the government is corrupt here. Like in the U.S., there's so many people who are just completely like, no, you know, they know their government is corrupt here, right? And they regularly stand up to it. They threw out the governor in 2017 and got another one. You know, and then the Puerto Rican people are just really, really lovely. And very open. I mean, they're Americans, and you know, there is some friction with the gringos, but not that much, really. I mean, they're pretty accepting and open and welcome. And there's still a lot of the older Puerto Ricans, they called Jibaro, that you know, live off the land and have the skills. There's
they call them what?
Jibaro,
which means what?
It just means like a rough translation would be like a country bumpkin or a. Not quite a redneck, but somebody who lives off the land.
Well, that's not a bad word. No,
I don't think so. It's considered a bad word because they went through a period like almost everybody where they thought, no, you know, having a car and getting a job and operating a computer.
Okay, let's talk about that. Is that stigma of being closer to the land and providing for yourself and, you know, homeschooling and the home growing and the home building and home, kiss my butt, you know, I'm home defense and home. I like this home thing. You know, is that being a starting to be elevated, you know, as a career, as a life choice? Is you starting to see that come around?
I think I am. Yeah, that is starting to come around, but it's still early days, you know, that it's still early days. Another thing that I really like about Puerto Rico is they made some tax incentives that are attracting a lot of the crypto community here. And I think that's a healthy thing, getting a lot of young entrepreneurs who are very familiar with blockchain and blockchain solutions and what can be done. There's a lot of very youthful entrepreneurial energy here. So, yeah, I really appreciate that. There is a real keen awareness when you live on an island. There's a real keen away, and we're like the bastard stepchild of the United States, and we know we are at the end of the food chain, right? You can pick up a can of anything, and you're almost near the expiration date. Like, we're the last ones to get anything, and we know that here, and people here know that. So there's a different, it's kind of like a small town mentality where people tend to take care of each other. Also, they've been through some major stuff. You know, they went through the
hurricanes,
Hurricane Maria. They went through some earthquakes. We just went through Hurricane Fiona. You know, I'm living in this town, and you know, we had no electric for 12 days, and no power I mean, people just, you know, they kind of mostly took it in stride. I mean, everybody had their issues, right? You know.
Well, you're familiar with Peter Schiff. We have him on the show regularly, and he's, you know, spends a lot of his time at his home there, and he's kind of the same mindset. You just got to be able to take care of yourself. And I thought you said you're in the same community or not too far from him or something. What's your community?
Yeah, I have not yet met him in person. We're part of a similar group. Where I see him posting, and I've reached out to him there, and I say, hey, Peter, you got to get me on your show, man. I think I sold about $1 million worth of gold to my community with another gold broker. Like, and I really want to get somebody who's on it about silver, and I would love to do a deal with him. So maybe you can do me an introduction to Peter personally.
Yeah, send me an email if you want to, whatever. I'll forward it to him. At least he'll look at it. I mean, you know, I can't make him do anything, but I'll get him on Donna. Schedule Peter Schiff. Tell him how much I want to, you know, love on him a little bit, wear him, come on, and then I'll sneak in some Marjorie Wildcraft, you know. There you go.
Yeah. Now, Peter's awesome. I like
him. You know, James Corbett and I do a regular show. What is today? Today is Tuesday. Is it Tuesday? Yeah, we do a show tomorrow. No, maybe next week. Anyway, every other Wednesday. And, James Corbett has really been pushing on solutions and food and all this kind of stuff. You'd be a great guest for that too. I'll encourage that, you know.
Awesome. I saw that last one you two did on community. I thought that was really good. I'm really so glad. That's the first realization you have when you start trying to grow food is you realize you can't do it as a family. You have got to have a community. You just have
to. Let's talk about that a little bit too. You know,
I can drill it down into one word why that's important.
Please.
Genetics. So
you hell? Got, you know, explain you yourself.
Right. Well, on all levels, it's so funny, you know, the survivalists, they all want to get way the hell out and live by themselves. I'm like, who are your children going to marry? But even aside from, even more simple than that is, you know, let's say you get your rabbits, right? You got your chickens. Well, rabbit, you need genetic diversity, right? You can't just have your rabbits in perpetuity. There have to be other people that are growing rabbits, and you swap bucks, and you have to have a certain genetic pool.
Well, you're talking longevity of creating a community as opposed to starting one, you know, I mean.
Absolutely. Right. But that is the reason. The same thing is with, like, let's say you're growing tomatoes, I'm growing, something freak happens and all your stuff is gone. You know, you can count on trading something with me and still have tomatoes, right? I can give you one other example. So when I first moved out to Red Rock, Texas, you know, we were doing it on our own, but I was on a big campaign to build community, and I would find people who were already doing it, and I attracted other people that were wanting to live this lifestyle. And just one other family. So we were growing, you know, we had the gardens, we had the chickens, and we had the rabbits, and then we also got into some miniature cattle, so we had beef. And just one other family, they had goats, of course, they had chickens and gardens also, and they had bees. So immediately they started having rabbits and beef that we were producing that we could trade with them. And we were able to get goat cheese and honey. I mean, just like, boom, you know, like it, you know what I mean? Just one other family. And all of a sudden we were starting to have more food security. And you really only need about 4 or 5 families, I think, of a group of you doing it.
As you grow as a community, as you start to, what do you see naturally occur? You start off with probably chickens and your suggestion of rabbits, and then of course vegetables and get your potatoes and so on. But when you start talking about larger farm animals, goats milk, tree production, citrus, apple, cherry, you know, whatever, and then maybe larger animals or bees. You know, give me the progression that you think it kind of develops.
You've kind of hit it right on the head there. I mean, but there's so many wonderful things to grow. But the absolute first three is to work on chickens, gardens, and rabbits, because those are going to be the fastest and easiest for you to set up, and you'll be producing.
Okay, well, that's what I wanted to know in the first 5 minutes of the show. So here we go. You know, chickens, rabbits, and vegetables. Ben, when do the larger farm, when do the goats come in? When does the sheep come in? When does the bees come in?
Yeah, that's going to depend on how much land you have. Before you do that, even if you don't have land, you got other things like mushrooms and bees, you know, and then you also learning canning skills and drying and freezing, There's also hunting and fishing. I mean, there's a lot of other things. And yes, there are the larger animals if you do have the room for it. So really, I'd say once you get past those first basic three, you ought to think about what you most want to eat. You know, what do you most like to eat, right?
Tuna fish sandwich. You know, whatever.
Tuna fish. Oh, my God.
Spam.
Spam.
Yeah. Hey, I was a kid. Spam was a thing, you know. But the that's one thing we can talk about is the processed food. You know, Spam, you just might as well lick a salt block. But, I mean, you know, I'm wondering, is there any canned anything that you would recommend as storage, or it's all dry goods?
You know, the most efficient, like least expensive, highest density calories that are going to have the longer shelf life are going to be your beans and your grains, and they're going to be the easiest to store. Personally, I like to store like coconut milk because it's high in fat in cans, and it'll last for a couple of years. It's very hard to store fats. Most fats go rancid pretty quickly, and most of your oils go rancid pretty quickly. But coconut milk can store for like 2 or 3 years and still be, you know, viable.
You know, that was one thing that I noticed. And okay, I'll give you a little history. We started doing Gerson therapy and some Budwig, you know, stuff just for health and such, and we went through that process. And I remember Budwig, which was in, you know, 30s Germany. This one woman doctor was, you know, realizing all the chronic diseases we started having were from industrialization of processed foods. And you're going, yeah, you're not getting the fats, you know, the oils, just kind of here, eat your Cheerios and shut up. Well, what happened was started to understand it was the oil. And when you look at processed oils, they did it for shelf life, you know, so they'd last, you know, months and years, whatever, on the shelf. Well, if you get a real good virgin olive oil, I mean, a good oil or a good, you know, something you got to, you know, or certain, you know, oils from nuts and different things, you got to eat it right away or, you know, or soon, because they go rancid. They start to go bad. Well,
yeah.
I just saw I was surfing, doing something on food, I don't know, whatever, doing my work on Freeman's Phoenix. And I saw they had a chart of what lasts long, this, and they put oils up there, oh, like indefinitely. And I go, not anything I want to eat. I mean, you know, so they're, yeah. So I go, never mind, I'm not using them as a resource, because they had, you know, cooking oils and different oils that you can just put that on the shelf forever. And I'm going, yeah. Nah, that's what screwed us up.
That's I think they developed the hydrogenated oils for the Navy, because the Navy had that problem of, you know, where do we get fats? And they found that this process of hydrogenating it didn't make it go bad. It just made the whole thing horrible. But, you know, it cooked and tasted or whatever, and they could get away with it. But yeah, that stuff's horrible. You don't want to eat that. That is completely horrible. That's, you know. Yeah. And one of the reasons I have the rabbits, and people go, well, do you butcher them right? You know, like if you look at the feed to weight conversion chart, like the optimal time for butchering is somewhere around 12 weeks. But I usually go ahead and feed them for a lot longer because I want them to get fat, because the fat is so valuable. Homesteaders in the United States, when we had the big homesteading movement, like in the 1800s or so, everybody would, you'd raise a pig, or even I was just in Mexico, in some of the backwoods of Mexico, they would raise a pig or two. They did not, the lean hogs we have now are a complete weird thing. They raised pigs that intentionally got really, really fat, because the fat was the valuable part of the pig.
We had some friends that had, they call them coonies or whatever. It's some, small pig.
Those little black ones. Yeah,
they vary in color, but yeah, the little ones. And they're made for pork bellies or probably a little Thai, you know, Asia, they whatever. So they had these pigs, and they grow pretty fast, but they only get to be about, I don't know, maybe, you know, 2 feet long and a foot high and round, you know, they become pigs. But, they eat just about everything, and they go through. And a lot of guys, you know, want to clear a land, they get pigs and they push all the rocks to the side and kind of clear a pasture. They use them for work while they're feeding them.
Yeah,
a lot of places, you know, don't like having, you know, you can't have any pigs, no pig farm, because they, you know, they live in their own filth and you don't rotate them or whatever, and they just smell. But, you know, how important are pigs? Is that an option for you? They're a good thing to have around. And these small pigs seem kind of, they're not going to eat my grandchildren. So, I mean, you know, they.
Yeah, you also, I tend to like smaller livestock just because I have processed a big pig, and like a cow, it's a lot of work, and you got to take care of that meat right away. You got to start rendering right. that fat right away. You've got to, I mean, it really is a project for a family or two families, everybody working to process a big animal. And that's usually why it was done in the fall, not only because that's when the pig was big, but that's also when the temperatures got down enough that meat would not spoil. So, but the smaller pigs, actually here in Puerto Rico, I want to get those black cooney pigs, because the Puerto Ricans have a superstition that the black pigs are no good. And I'm glad for that. They say, no, if you raise the pigs, they're going to steal them. People love pigs so much, they're going to steal it. I'm like, okay.
Okay, let's get one thing. You'd used a technical term, you know, render the fat. I hear that all the freaking, render it. Render, what the hell does that even mean? Explain rendering fat to me.
So you got this big chunk of blubber, right? And maybe the blubber from all around the organs or just under the skin. What you do is you put that in a pot and you keep it on a medium low heat, and you just let it cook for a long time. And it changes from being this stuff that would decay right away, and it turns into more of like a pure, it turns into the kind of fat you're thinking of. Like it turns from lard, right? And it stores a whole lot longer, especially if you can keep it cool and dark. Lard will store a lot longer than the fat.
Do you kind of can it? Do you put it in a canning jar kind of deal? You heat it and then you can put it on the shelf?
Yeah, you would want to.
And how
do
long
that.
Would that last?
Gosh, you know, I'd have to look that up. I'm thinking a year or two. I mean, that would be another process.
So people, when you're doing, let's just do some practical application.
Honestly, Ernie, whenever I had that lard, we ate it up so fast because it was delicious, you know.
Yummy! You know, it's like, you know, what about things like bacon? You a bacon fan?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, they're saying that, you know, bacon you get from the store is so processed and salted and blah, 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 blah. That may not be the same as, you know, processing your own pig. I mean, what's the difference?
No, it's not. And that's one of the reasons you're going to want to learn to smoke your meats to preserve them and salt them. That's part of the reason why we have salted smoked bacon, is because that's what people used to do in order to preserve the meat. And it works even in hot climates. My father-in-law grew up in South Texas, and he said, yeah, we had a smokehouse. We had a smokehouse and kept the meat in it all summer in the smokehouse. You know, you just have to get a little fire going every day to keep the smoke, you know. And what it is insects really avoid smoke, right? Smoke to an insect is like a danger alarm, right? In fact, you've heard about the ritual where you smoke yourself, or somebody has a stick where they've got all this smoke and they do it to clean you. That actually comes from a very, very practical Native American tradition. When I was living and doing a lot of the wilderness skills and survival skills, we build these like debris huts where you take a whole bunch of leaves and sticks and stuff and turn it into this little hut so you could stay warm at night, because you didn't have blankets and you're just living out with whatever you have on your back, right? So you'd build this debris hut. Well, right after you built it, you could stay in that first night, but the next night or even the next week or whenever it would be full of insects because it's a fantastic habitat, right? So what I would do, and I had one on the back 40, this debris hut that I built that I would go into and camp out in. And what I would do is I would take a smoke stick and to smoke out that hut. And that's what the Native Americans would do. They would smoke out their, you know, their teepees or their structures. And it would be amazing, like get the smoke going and you would see everything coming out of that debris hut. Like all the insects are leaving because they don't want to be around
debris hut. What do you mean debris hut? You know, just, you know, you had twigs and stuff in there to smoke or whatever?
Yeah, you take a structure and you use a bunch of sticks to make like the skeleton of the structure. And then you pile a bunch of leaves and brush on it. And then you make another layer of sticks to another skeleton and then more leaves. and you it's called a debris hut because you're using the debris of the forest, and you build this structure that you can then stay in, and you'll stay warm because you're surrounded and basically insulated from the cold.
You know what I need? I need Marjorie to be on Naked and Afraid. Put you on Survivor or whatever. I see these people, I'm going, one thing, you know, being cold, that sucks. I'd vote not that. The other thing is that all the bugs, they get like every square inch on their body and bitten. I'm going, screw that. You know, so in a grid down situation of, oh my God, Marjorie's going to be living large and everybody wants to be, you know, your friend, you know, and spoon with you in your hut, you know, what is the first things that you would do, you know?
Some of these images already,
Naked and Afraid, their first night, they're all bundling up together because they're freaking cold, you know?
Believe me, yeah, we used to do this wonderful thing where we'd take teens out, and you can't bring anything, no lip balm and no water bottles or nothing, and just whatever you have, whatever shirt you have or whatever, and we would take them out into actually it was the Sonoran Desert. We would do it outside southwest of Phoenix there. There's a gathering that happens every February called Winter Count, and we used to take the kids out. And
I'm in Tonopah right now.
Oh, you should go there. It's really fun. Yeah. Oh God, did it just happen? It might have just happened. It was a really fun event. I went there for years. Yeah, we would take the kids out. You know, you're freezing your ass off, and yeah, what you body heat, man, it works.
Hey, you know, I don't like being cold. Homie, don't like cold. You know,
nobody does. Yeah.
Well, what are some of the survival skills? Let's do that. Let's spend a couple of minutes on that. We got time.
Well, you know, honestly, Ernie, we're not ever going to really be that. I mean, there's so many buildings, right? You have a home, right? The chances that, you know, I mean, that the wilderness stuff, you're not going to probably be out in the wilderness. That's not a really high
problem.
Oh, you got it out with your rifle.
Help me out, Marjorie. I'm in the wilderness. What do I got to worry about? You know, because it, you know, one thing that you just said that is very useful is that to get the you're out in the place and you got the shelter, because we have different shelters that we make, you know. But you want to get the insects out, the smoking of it. That's a good thing to know. And then
you also
got to
be real careful. You want the scorpions out. You also got to be very careful not to, because you've got a huge tinder bundle there. You got to be careful not to set your own debris hut on fire. But the reason I was talking about smoke is that is the basic principle for your meat. So people hung meats in smokehouses, and the principle is that insects, and it will also stop. Decay is the smoke and the salt. And that's how you can keep meat for a lot longer than you would if you just like had it on the counter.
You know, you have freezers. A lot of people that do deep freezers, they'll put stuff in, but then you got to keep it going. And we lost a lot of grass-fed, friend of mine does, you know, organic, whatever, Missouri beef that we had in a deep freezer in the garage that went out, and then we lost it all. And I go, well, that sucks. Then you have electricity goes out, and you lose all that. Then we'll go solar, and we have battery, kind of, you know, new priority of making sure you don't lose your deep freeze. But if I were to smoke meat and I put it in a freezer, is that better, or I don't need to put it in the freezer? Or is there a point that I'm done? I put it in Mylar and seal it, or I got to eat it? What?
Yeah, well, you know, the idea of a smokehouse is you keep the smokehouse going, and you don't actually have to ever freeze that meat. That's how people stored meat.
Oh, so when you smoke meat, it's constantly being smoked.
Well, it's not constantly, but you would like make sure you re-smoke it once a day. You make a little small smoke fire and get it going, just to constantly keep a little bit of smoke going in there, and not like it doesn't have to go 24 hours a day, but you want to. You know, just make sure you freshen.
So what are you thinking about freeze-dried and, you know, sealed and cooked and boiled and canned? And what's your preference?
You know what? I have done a ton of freeze-dried stuff. Here's the problem with freeze-dried now
or
is
dehydrated
totally
or something.
Yeah, well, freeze-dried is great. I mean, you got a shelf life of, you know, years, decades even. And some of the fruits and the herbs and the food is just incredible when you rehydrate.
But those things are not free.
They're not free. There's a huge electrical expense for those. There's also a lot of work. I mean, I've done a lot of freeze drying. It's a lot of work. You need to prep the thing, put it on the trays. You know, it's 24 hours, 48 hours, depending on what you're freeze drying. it is fantastic because you've got really, really good high quality food in there, and it does last a long time, but it is a lot of work and it's very expensive. And, you know, I love, you know, what is it, Harvest Right or something like that? They have really great freeze dryers. I really, you know, I love their products. Dehydrating is awesome. You make sure you that stuff is really dried, and then you can, you know, lock that down into jars or pails and make sure you got some oxygen absorbers or something in there to, you know, keep that moisture out. You know, you're really going to want to learn all the different skills. Canning is another great way to, especially for those people that live in the temperate climates where you've really only got one growing season. Like when I live in Colorado.
Well, you almost want one growing season. If you're living in Puerto Rico, you're never not making food. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, can I take a break sometime? Holy crap. Because we were up in Washington State this last summer doing some prototype building dome stuff. And they had a big garden. You know, they had a lot, you know, they had greenhouses. They had four greenhouses. I mean, they're a farm of food production. We're not dying. I mean, they saw the, you know, the Marjorie Wildcraft DVD, man. They went and visited Saladin, and I mean, they're all into it. Well, the girls that they have working for them tending the gardens, they had like strawberry bushes that were awesome, but they don't come to fruition and ready to pick all at once. I mean, you know, there's like a time there. You're every day you're going out getting the best strawberry, the ripe ones and so on. But then you're out the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day. And they would slice them and they put it on freeze dry trays and they put those in. But that the freeze dry, they had to get, you know, like the $20,000 version or whatever to keep up because you're producing so much. Well, as they're doing all this food production and preserving and saving, because they're building up for here it comes, they start digging out a big root cellar, and they're taking this seriously. Well,
good.
Then they got, you know, buffalo. And then you got to get buffalo fences, I mean, because you got buffalo. Then you have the coney pigs, and then you got to get the, God, what do they call it, Napa, whatever, these big Pyrenees, you know, dogs to, you know, guard all the chickens and the whatever the hell, because they had weasels get in and kill the chickens, and, you know, yada, 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 yada. It's work. And when you're doing all this food production, food preservation, food prepping, food canning, food, yep, you're doing nothing else. I mean, you're working. You know, this
well, that's, you know, and you're, but they're a business, Ernie. They're a business. The simple system that I recommend to people with the rabbits, the chickens, and the garden, you'll only be working in that like a half an hour, maybe an hour a day at the most. And you're producing at least half of your own food, right? You know, yes, you can start going crazy and that's wonderful, but you're talking about a business. Like,
no, nobody, they weren't business. They were a big family that wanted, you know, their friends and so on. But I understand your point. My point is, yeah, is that for a family of, you know, six, you know, a couple, you know, and maybe grandparents, a couple kids or four kids or whatever, you get like six people. And you have, you know, dad's out building. I'm going to be doing a lot of construction and building and doing that. And Donna probably, like we did at our home in North Phoenix, we had an aquaponics thing that we tried. I like raised beds more. We'll talk about that too. But the chickens and everything, if we get back into a, you know, a routine to where we're doing, I mean, how much time and how many months out of the year are we producing the food, prepping the food, storing the food, and then we got like a year's worth of rice and beans and whatever so we can kind of, you know, start building back up our stocks. So let's say we do the Mormon thing, we get 2 years. I got 2 years of, which is really not that much. You get some rice and beans, whatever it costs you, I mean, $500, $1,000, you get the right stuff, you're fine, at least for a while before you start producing. And then you're going to need to have some fresh vegetables and get your minerals and, you know, vitamins and kind of, you know, eat right. But, you know, how many months of the year am I working? You're saying like an hour a day, you know, which is going to be 2-3 hours. But you got an hour to 3 hours.
No, it really is about an hour a day. And it's every day. It's not every day an hour. It's, you know, some days are just a few minutes. Like you just dumping some feed for the rabbits, you're checking on the chickens, and you're making sure the water, the garden's not dry because you've got to run and the tire's flat and somebody's got a dentist appointment. You know, there's all that going on, right? But then there are times when, yeah, you know, that Saturday you're going to be working all day building the chicken coop, or, you know, you're going to be working a half a day on Sunday between seasons to, you know, turn over the compost pile and fertilize the garden and
butchering and processing and getting the whatever you got things to do.
Yeah. So, but on average, I mean, really somewhere between an hour and a half hour a day for a person to grow half of their own food is a benchmark. And so, like, let's say you got a family of six and, you know, someone's unemployed, you know, basically that person could be dedicated to working full time on growing the food for the family. That would be the most meaningful work that they could possibly do. You're going to cut down on everybody's healthcare bills. You're going to be producing nutrition. You're going to be producing food, you know, you're going to be building family bonds in a way that you've never built before.
You know, here's something to take into consideration. A good friend of mine, Jay, in New Hampshire, he made a big deal out of kids getting their dopamine hits from other than their cell phone. I mean, as they're playing games of whatever the hell. So his children, you know, they raised their dopamine hits is taking care of six chickens and going and getting eggs. And then they go out and feed the pigs and all that. You know, they're, you know, because they get a lot of positive feedback from the animals. You know, they get to go pick the eggs and everything. I mean, to have, and I never really thought of it that way. He goes, no, it's a dopamine hit. It's like, you know, they're, ooh, I got an egg. Ooh, I got it. As opposed to, ooh, I may Mario got a mushroom or something. I mean, you know, trade off definitely for that.
Yeah, traditionally taking care of the chickens and collecting eggs was the children's work.
My grandkids, they loved it. You know, and this is one thing that really, you know, I really identify with.
Oh my
this.
God, you know, Ernie, I hate to, like, we've been at this a while now, and I'm realizing I got another appointment coming
up. Oh, we got so much to do. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and wrap it up. But I tell you, you know, I wanted to reintroduce you to the audience because
you did that in a big way.
It's going to be a food thing. You know, Marjorie Wildcraft is, are you liking Puerto Rico? You think you're going to be staying there?
Oh, this is it. Yeah. You know, I'm going to hunker down here. I love it here.
And the climate, you know, is productive to freaking grow. Are you up in the mountains at all, or are you down closer? Is it warm?
It's warm. Yeah. I've actually got two places because one of my business partners is a farmer and she likes being inland in the mountains. And I've kind of got a little kind of a bug out facility or place I go there from time to time when I need to just get away from everybody and spend time in the jungle. And then, but I mostly live, I like living, my favorite place to live is going to be near a small town where I can, you know, walk through the Pueblo and I know everybody and they know me and I'm organizing events and we're having fun. I don't want to be on the beach. I that's not my thing. The soils are salty. You're the first one to get slammed with a hurricane. So I want to be inland a little bit. But I like being near a fun, funky.
Well, when you went to Anarkopoko, did you feel you were among your tribe? I mean, you know.
Oh my gosh! You know, I have to say, Ernie, I go to Edward Griffin's Red Pill thing, and I've gone to John Bush's Greater Reset. You know, I do the Mother Earth News. I do the Survival Preparedness Expo. You know, I'm actually going to cut out a lot of traveling. I'm kind of done with it. Anarkopoko, hands down, the funnest event. And I can tell you why. You know, if you go to the Greater Reset, there's a lot of people who are waking up. And when people first wake up, they're angry. They're not as fun to be around. Almost everybody in Anarkopoko has been knowing this is coming down for at least a decade, not two. And, you know, we're like, hey, we know it's coming. Like, what do I need to learn next? And pass me that doobie and hand me that beer. You know, I mean, we're all having a good time, right? You know.
So. Now, you were a rock star there. Everybody, you know, you spent some time with me and Donna, and everybody kind of go, girl. You know, go be with your peoples, man, because they didn't want to hog up your time. But it's great to get caught up again, and we'll start doing some more work. Yeah, we'll have you on again soon because it's going to be a food thing. I'm with you, sister.
You're absolutely right, Ernie. Hey, you guys have a good time, and God bless Donna for managing you.
Yeah, that's what she does. All right,
we'll talk to you later.
Peace, Marjorie. Bye.
Your smile.